Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanners. So let's be friends. We've got a little bit of midweek content to whet your appetite for the Australian Grand Prix. We had the opportunity to catch up with two very, very interesting individuals, so I thought I'd grab it. Coming up first, we're going to have an interview with Harry Benjamin, who has done a lot of Junior Series commentary, Porsche Super Cup, and will be filling in for David Croft. Crofty on Sky for three races this season. And then me and Matt were able to catch up with someone you might not have heard of called Tim Sylvie, who has done a lot of sponsorship work within F1. So a really fascinating chat we had with him about driver sponsorship, team sponsorship, and also how the personalities in F1 affect the amount of sponsorship and how easy they are to then market. He's also from the race media and WTF1 and Motormouth podcast. So he is really connected all throughout the industry, and it was a lovely chat. If you want to join us for the Australian Grand Prix, the timings are going to be a bit different for the live stream. I think we're going to go live from around 9:30 a.m. and then the episode will be out, early afternoon. So you'll be able to catch it as normal on a Sunday evening as well. Are you staying up until 4 a.m.? Until 4 a.m.? Or are you waking up for 4 a.m.? It is actually on the borderline. If it was 3 a.m., I'd probably stay up. But given that it's 4 a.m., I'll try and get a nap in and then wake up for the race. So I will see the real people in the UK live online before the race at 4 a.m. And then I'll catch up with you sleepyheads a little bit later. Gosh, the people around the world don't understand how hard we have it here in the UK. Okay, we will now go to my chat with Harry Benjamin. As you know, I am one of the greatest commentators that ever there was, and that's why my career lasted broadly 2 seasons, and there is no documentary evidence of me doing it because I've buried it in a lead case and pushed it to the bottom of the sea. But I do enjoy the art of commentary. I'm passionate about it, which is why I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Sky's latest F1 signing. It's only Harry Benjamin in the shed. Hello, Harry.
What an honour. Thank you so much for having me, Spanners. To be in commentary royalty with you is just something exceptional.
Just so you know, we would have invited you back into the shed, not just because you're now the new king of Sky F1, but that is really exciting that you're going to be subbing in for three races for F1.
Yeah, it's mega. I wouldn't call myself the king.
I've still got a lot to learn.
When I got the phone call in, I think just before Austin last year, I had a, you know, when the boss of Sky F1 calls, you answer the phone pretty damn quickly. So, it wasn't something I was expecting. I was just doing my thing.
Really?
I'd had a bit of crossover with Sky already. I did the first F1 Juniors, where they changed the name to F1 Kids. And I was doing F1 Academy, and that had a bit of crossover with Sky as well. So I kind of knew them a little bit, but you know, you live in and you dream, but I didn't see any real, there was no openings, you know, and there's never any job applications online open for this kind of thing. So then to get the phone calls, be like, yeah, there's three races. We'd like you to do them. Are you free? You go, yeah, even if I'm not free, I'm free.
Well, so. Yeah, one's my mother's birthday. One is my kid's coronation to be Prince of Sweden. But I'll cancel all that to do it. Now, you absolutely have to grab that. I actually brought Harry on to talk about the art of commentary, but now I'm just being nosy about his career because it's just very exciting to know that when you take the mic, I'll have spoken to you in the shed. So it is an indictment to how long the season is that even David Croft, who hasn't ever missed a race, I don't think, suddenly goes, do you know what? 24 is a bit much.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've only done two and I'm exhausted. So, so
the 24.
So 24, it is a lot. I think it's too many personally. I think 16 is probably the sweet spot in my own personal opinion. And no one really does the full season now. If you look at everybody on various different broadcast teams, it all chops and changes, and people have families, believe it or not, and want to spend some weekends at home, or they just they have other endeavors that they want to do and that kind of thing. So to get the call up to do three, I'm doing Imola, Austria, and Baku. So pretty excited for those ones actually. So they're a good sort of selection to get. I'm very excited, and I'm doing all that alongside doing the other races for the BBC.
Which races they are again?
Busy.
Baku.
So Imola, Austria, Baku.
There, yeah. Oh wow, you're doing Austria. Okay, so Austria's like genuinely tons of action as well. My mind instantly now when you say Austria was those five midfielders where they're like five abreast going into turn three. For a little track, that does bring up good racing. Actually, it's pretty similar to the Vegas kind of concept. Let's just have some drag strips and some big stops.
Yeah, and like, I love the location for it, you know, in sort of the Styrian Mountains, and it's a sprint weekend as well, so we'll get sort of double dosage of racing. And I do kind of like a sprint weekend because it reduces the amount of practice. I do, only because it reduces... I'm not fully on board yet with the format, but I like the fact that we only have one practice session because I think that puts more pressure on the teams and the drivers to do a good job, which I'm here for. We go into qualifying and the racing in a bit of an unknown. And for the broadcasters, you get into the nitty gritty of it quicker.
That's true. It is definitely like the newer audiences with less patience. And I include myself in that because as a kid, I loved ET and it was perfectly well paced. Watch ET now. It's the most boring film you've ever seen. It just does not get to the point. So I'm trying to be ungrumpy about sprint weekends because they're here to stay. But on the one hand, you're saying 16 races would be just fine. But within one weekend, look at you. You don't mind. You don't mind limitless races. But if you're there, I really think the broadcast teams, because they're there, it occupies them. It's a lot more interesting for you guys.
Yeah, oh, totally. I mean, I was all batting the drum for reverse grid championship order sprint. I in my head, if we're going to do a sprint, it's a novelty, it's entertainment. It's that's purely why it's being brought in, for entertainment reasons.
Yeah.
Let's go crazy with it. Reverse championship order. Sargent starts on pole alongside Kevin Magnussen. Yeah, okay, they might drop down through the field, but a sprint race is a short race. They might not drop all the way to the back. And if Verstappen's at the back, he's not exactly going to have a great time cutting through because he hasn't got Sargent and Magnussen, etc. in front of him. He's going to have Perez. He's going to have Leclerc right in front of him, who are going to be battling over 17th place just as hard as they're going to be battling over second and third. So it could lead to more opportunity for those minnow teams to get some smaller points and you know, a bit of a good fun entertainment story. So that's I would have gone with. But then again, I'm not the boss of Formula One. So
yet. But I would say be careful what you wish for, because have you ever commentated reverse grid races? Because I've tried it and it is horrendous to try and follow what's going on. So the temptation is, well, don't care about the guys at the front, because they're there for the wrong reasons. But you can't ignore the race up there. It would be a challenge.
No, I mean, I've done loads of reverse grid races before. Everyone seems to forget that I did do Formula 3 for like a year and a half. So,
yeah, sorry.
So, and that is like a sprint reverse weekend. Like, it's in line with the support categories. So, if we're going to go down that route of entertainment, which I think we should because I want to be entertained, then chuck everything at it. You know, I think about it with other racing series as well. I look at Formula E and go, I think they just need to go absolutely crazy with it. And make it the most insane thing in the world, and you'll get people watching it.
Reverse grids are fun. If you've got a formula where people can overtake, that's going to be the important thing. And picking which track you do it at, because obviously pointless doing it at Monaco. But yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. I think I'm losing the battle as a middle-aged man of trying to cling on to what F1 was in 1997. And it's never going to happen. It is moving on. Sprint weekends are a reality. So I suppose I've just got to be less grumpy about it. But not immediately.
Yeah, but
I'm going to resist.
No. Look, you can not like it, but and you know, there's plenty of other racing this year to watch as well. So if you miss the sprint races, you'll still have a good chunk of the calendar to watch as well.
Yeah, you've got actually. I mean, you're on the second best MotoGP podcast out there, aren't you? As well, so you know, there's even MotoGP. Mm. Yeah,
I hear that. Yeah, no, but the first round wasn't that entertaining.
Oh, wasn't it?
I haven't listened. Yeah, so, but Moto 2 and Moto 3. I love the way MotoGP and the support classes are intertwined in a race weekend. I don't think it's possible to do that on a Formula 1 race weekend, but I love how they are kind of given just as much sort of airtime and they're ingrained into the full broadcast as MotoGP is, whereas F2 and F3 aren't.
But that's it. But they should be. And I'm sure there was a time when they were at a lot more races. Is it alternate events now? They certainly seems like a much more cut down calendar. But why not promote? You've got F2 and F3 there. And I wondered whether not showing F2 as much might be down to the fact that F2 is often much more exciting and interesting to watch than the F1. And it might show it up.
Well, look, I mean, look, I know Sky broadcast them. Absolutely. And they do sometimes a bit of wraparound coverage, but the way MotoGP does it, you know, it's Susie Perry who anchors all of it with the pundits and that kind of thing, and it's one sort of all-day broadcast, which I think would be mega to have an F1 covering Formula 2 and Formula 3. There's many reasons, logistical, time, and Formula 1 requires so much work and effort. That there just isn't always time in the schedule to allow for that. So that's probably why.
If you go to a Grand Prix like Silverstone, where it's got a packed support calendar, that's a good day out. And so like you're there, because the whole thing was with sprint weekends, well, the people who have attended need more things to watch. But even like you have a W Series race and you see those cars thundering around at Silverstone, that's not nothing. You know, that's entertaining. You know, Porsche Super Cup there, F2, F3. Like, you go to Silverstone for a Grand Prix weekend and your day is full and you go, oh yeah, F1. Oh, yeah, I forgot the F1.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, especially for those who are trackside, you know, and Formula 1 is not a cheap hobby to go and enjoy as a fan. So the more sort of categories and things on track that you can see, the more bang for your buck. So I'm all for that because that's what the fans deserve.
All right. Let's talk about the art of commentary. Sorry, we've completely tangented and I got caught down a rabbit hole just being excited for you filling in those three races. You're going to get the Ollie Bearman treatment. Everyone, you're going to be the Ollie Bearman of commentary.
I hope I get FP1 and FP2 before I chuck into FP3. That would be the hope.
I want to hear the producers.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited.
I want to hear the producers in your ear going, yeah, just take it steady. Don't put it in the wall, Harry. Just keep it on track.
Don't be a hero.
Yeah, don't be a hero. Start on the soft mic, on the soft compression mic before you blow out the large compressor. But look, commentary as an art form, I find it fascinating in the UK especially that there's been an evolution of everybody having to be like Murray Walker. And as somebody who was sort of dancing around at the very bottom end of the motorsport commentary ladder, you do find that everyone who's coming through almost feels a pressure to be Murray Walker or David Croft now. And it's sort of hard to imagine that if Murray Walker didn't exist, motorsport commentary might be very different. You could imagine a world where it's more like snooker or test cricket.
Well, that would be something different, wouldn't it? It's interesting. I don't feel that pressure, really. Maybe it's because I mean, I didn't grow up with Murray Walker. Obviously, I look back at his commentary and I've seen clips of it, and I know that, you know, everyone will jaw dropped at that one. But you know, I was born in 1997, and I Formula One interest came a little bit later. I was maybe around 12 years old at that time, and I mainly grew up on the latter part of the BBC's coverage and when they were on the TV, and then Sky. I remember Sky Sports' first broadcast, 2012 Australia, like it was yesterday, and sitting up really early in my room watching it. And I wanted to do what Simon Lazenby or Crofty or Brundle or whatever them lot were doing. That's what I just wanted to be there. And I loved the stories off the track as much as I loved the on-track action. There's obviously pressure, and I feel like I have that, you know, constant voice in my head, which is like, you're not really a commentator. Like, how the hell have you ended up here?
How have you blagged this living?
I remember having a meeting in 2020. Yeah. I just graduated from university into a pandemic, which is great, and so nothing to do. And I managed to get an online meeting with the head of broadcast at Formula One just for a chat. And he said, "Have you ever done any commentary?" And I went,
"Just say yes. Just say yes. Just say yes."
Like, I went, "Yeah, a little bit. You know, not much, but you know, I've done a bit." And I just love Formula One. I love motorsport. I watch Formula 3. I love F2. And he went, "Okay, good to know. Good to know." And then 4 months later, I think I got invited to Biggin Hill, which is where the Formula One Media and Technology Center is based, to sit in and just sort of shadow a weekend in the gallery. During the Bahrain Grand Prix, thought I'd be there for a couple of hours on the Sunday. I was there for a lot longer because of a lengthy red flag for Romain Grosjean's Haas. So that was a long day.
That was your first
office,
day.
If we all remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just there shadowing, and I ended up shadowing quite an intense broadcast, which is amazing. And then I heard nothing for ages. And then the April came around the following year, and an opening came up with Porsche Super Cup, and I grabbed it with both arms and just thought, this is my in here, let's do it. So that was kind of how I got into commentary. So I didn't have any, you know, we talk about the art of commentary. I only had what I had watched and heard, you know, the Crofties, the Will Buxtons, the Alex Jakeses, and that's all I really had to go off. So that was the sort of, okay, this is how motorsport is done. I'm watching other series. Because, and now I use this a lot in my other commentary when I do Formula One for the radio, for BBC Radio 5 Live. Within kind of radio and 5 Live, a lot of commentators do a bit of everything. You know, they'll do football, they'll do tennis, they'll do rugby, they'll do whatever it might be. They can sort of switch and adapt quite easily. And I think, speaking from a personal experience and also in general, I don't think many of them could do a Formula One commentary just like that, but I think a Formula One commentator could go off and do whatever else it was, purely because F1 is so unique and niche, and you have to manage the energy so well. There are so many extenuating factors, and you make or break the broadcast, really. It could be the most boring race on earth, and you can't flog a dead horse, but you can find elements that make it a little more interesting to watch.
Oh,
and that's the art of being a commentator in my book.
Yeah, the criticism is, I guess, unearned moments of ecstasy from commentators, because everybody wants the "and there goes Hamilton" moment. And when it's organic, it's wonderful. But you do see a lot of commentators go, and will they make the move happen now? Oh, no, they didn't again for the seventh lap in a row. So it's about, you know that moment's in you when it comes, and it's trying to judge when the moment deserves it. But there are a lot of races in Formula One where really there isn't a lot going on visually.
No. And then I got to the end of the Bahrain Grand Prix and I turned to my producer and I just said, I don't know how we just managed to do 2 hours of that. Because you're basically clinging on for dear life and going, well, the gaps are kind of stabilized, but there is a good battle for 12th developing. And
kind of.
In my head, I know that the battle for 12th is not universally appealable, but
I was last weekend.
Well, exactly. But but you've got to tell the story of the race up and down the field for a start. And The way I do my commentary personally is I like to inject my personality. I like to have a bit of a laugh. I'll say on air, the battle for 12th, no points up for grab, but there's pride at stake here. I know it's 12th, but it's the closest thing we have right now on track.
Yeah, you've got to acknowledge it. Like,
you've got to acknowledge it. I don't like thinking I'm going in blind. Like, I am a fan. I'm going in and I know how I watch Formula One, although I don't watch a lot of it anymore because normally I'm doing it. So, you know, I haven't watched a full broadcast in a long time. So it is difficult. Commentary is really hard. And I think a lot of people, and I'm not just saying this, I'm not trying to get, oh, woe is me, I'm a commentator.
But you're so good.
It is hard.
No.
It is hard. People underestimate it. And people, especially nowadays on social media, are so quick to scrutinize. And they have no idea what else is going on in that commentary box. It's not just looking at a TV screen. You're often looking at a TV screen that is, you know, tiny. You're not getting your 50-inch at home. And you've got a couple of timing screens. You've got a producer in your ear, perhaps several people in your ear talking to you at the same time as you are also talking and doing commentary. You've got your co-commentator who might have spotted something and wants to talk. You might have a third person in there who wants to say something or is trying to direct your attention there. And you have got to manage all of this while telling the story of the race, remembering what happened at the start, and just holding a live broadcast together. And that, you know, that is hard work, and when mistakes happen, I made a mistake last week, but I've learned not to beat myself up. I think it was Piastri going for the move on Hamilton, and I knew it was Piastri going for Hamilton, but for some reason I said Norris, and I was like, I don't know why I've just said Norris. It's Piastri.
Just acknowledge
but
it.
In the heat of the moment, you those little slips will happen, and if you beat yourself up on it, then you won't last. But people are far too quick, and I really don't like it, to jump on mistakes and little slip-ups by commentators and broadcast teams, especially those who are starting brand new. You know, there's commentators that have come in that don't have much commentary experience or whatever, and people are so quick to judge. And I just think that's not right. And you wouldn't have got that 10 years ago when Crofty was starting or when Alex Jakes was starting or when Will Buxton was starting. You didn't get that then.
No, thankfully, I'm in, you know, podcasting, and no one ever says anything bad about what podcasters do. But the standard, actually, in commentary in general, and I think, you know, it's brave of you that you admitted to lying to an F1 person when they said, you know, how's your commentary?
It's not lying. It
feels
just
a bit like lying.
Not telling the truth.
It's entirely inventing a version.
Best bit of advice, two bits of advice I was ever given. Don't be a, can I swear? I'm just going to say it. You can bleep it out ever. Don't be a, and you say yes, figure it out later.
Yes. You know, you have to do that. And I'm not going to be a hypocrite here because I've done exactly the same thing. I had a 2-year karting gig that came from a phone call that said, I've heard you're a commentator. And I said, yes, I'd literally done none. I went, yeah, fine. And because I just wanted the gig. So I booked the gig, figured it out when I got there, and I had 2 years in that series. And the truth wouldn't have got me anywhere, kids. But a lot of it is like luck and circumstance as well. You know, they needed a person and you're the person they're talking to.
But you were obviously in the right circles. You'd put yourself in a position where you were a name that had been thrown around. And that's not luck. That's
you're good.
Putting yourself in as many places.
You're good at networking. I need to learn from you about networking.
I wouldn't say I'm a good networker. I just go, hello. How are you?
Well, it's because you're eight foot tall as well. So people go, oh, who's that person?
Yeah.
He's 8 foot tall. He must be.
Yeah, when you're tall, it's easier when you're tall.
He must be good at consuming resources. Bring him into the tribe. Yeah, that's good. So I loved how impassionate you were about the stick that some people give to commentators, because David Croft gets a lot of stick for online, which is insane because he's literally one of the best Mike Smith's vocal commentators that has ever graced motorsport.
I've had a lot of messages and a lot of, you know, interview requests and all this kind of thing. And even just being in the paddock in Bahrain, I went to a couple of races last year. Nobody really knew who I was, I don't think. But, you know, I now do get glances and...
glances
good
up.
And bad.
Oh, right. Oh, look at them.
Good and bad, and I'm fully aware of that. I've obviously got enough confidence within myself to know that I'll do a good job. I might not be everyone's cup of tea, and there'll be a lot of people who don't like me, and that's fine because I'm aware that's just
the internet now
of the role.
Yeah,
but that's what you get when you sort of go for public facing roles, I suppose. Like, I don't do it to be famous or whatever. I do it because I love Formula One, and if you want to be the top in the top in Formula One, that comes with the public scrutiny.
No, but it's so
right?
sad, isn't it? Like, but you, it's not caveat. Just scrutiny. You have to accept you're going to get online abuse. And that's like, it's, you'd say, like, even in the shed level podcaster I am, I occasionally show my son. Like, I would weekly and then around races, multiple a day, just abusive messages. And you kind of go now, you kind of go, well, that's just part of the job. And you go, that isn't it sad that to do anything front facing, you just have to accept you're going to get abuse?
Yeah, and you know what? Touch wood. Luckily, up till now, you know, I haven't had anything too bad. And when I do, like, I got a lot of stick just with the announcement that happened. I can't remember what it was a couple of months ago. And people are already judging me. And I was like, have you even heard me commentate? A lot of people confusing me for other people and being critical.
Who are you being
and
confused someone, with?
Just other, I won't name it, just other commentators. Okay. But I find it funny because unless I'm being critiqued by somebody within the industry who I deem knows their stuff and who is above me or works, you know, is employing me. If the boss of Sky is criticizing me, I will listen. If David and Allison 997 on Twitter are saying that I'm rubbish, or if somebody actually did tweet a picture of me and I actually found it quite funny, being like, who is this guy? Never heard of him. Is he which Jonas brother is this?
And
I
just
went, I don't know. I think there's three Jonas brothers. So I just went, I'm the fourth one. So I find it quite funny, but that's because I think I'm willing to take it. And look, if I make a mistake, you be rest assured, I will be beating myself up over it. But at the same time, this is not brain surgery. It's Formula One. It's entertainment. It's sports. And that is what I'm telling myself to keep my feet well and truly on the ground.
You will only, like most likely, you will only be criticized and abused by people doing less than you at this given moment. So I'm sorry, I keep diverting back because it's just so exciting. But
I
really enjoyed
the... We're going to talk about the art of commentary, right?
We kind of have. I think we have. The fact that you're so busy in there and you're like a mental octopus with all those screens. One thing I found from going from karting commentary to then the few times I went and did it at a track is you suddenly go, oh, you can't see the whole race all the time. You get this one little section of track. And you kind of go, well, you know, there's lots of broadcasts that don't even go to the tracks for all the races. Yeah. You know, I've sat in the BBC comms seats before, and it's really not that different to being at the track, I suppose, when you've got the screens, because that's all you were going to have at the track anyway.
Yep, and that's the way it's going. The majority of broadcasts will be done remotely going forward. There's no doubt about that because it's sustainable, it saves a lot more money. And as you've just said, you don't always need to be there. The problem is, and I'm happy to say that publicly now, because before I used to go, oh, it's so much better being there. And actually, it is when you're starting, like me, first couple of years, it's so important from a work perspective to meet the team PRs in person, to try and get any kind of relationship you can with the drivers. To know the processes, you know, in Bahrain, I got invited to a commentator's briefing with Andrea Stella, and it was so useful. And I wouldn't have got that if I was doing it remotely. And it was absolutely fantastic. And also, especially when you're doing the radio, you've got to be incredibly descriptive. So if you're actually there, it makes a world of difference because you can feel the atmosphere. You can see the grandstands are full. I can tell you exactly what garages the commentary box is opposite. Like Japan last year was amazing as well. It's like an amphitheater that you do actually see the whole track from the Japanese commentary box. It's fantastic.
Oh,
but,
do you? Oh, because, yeah, it's quite
well,
tight,
pretty
isn't
much,
it?
Yeah. But you're right at the top of the main grandstand, right at the back, and it's honestly amazing. And it's one of the best views. But then you can get, like, terrible views where you don't even have a window at some time. Like Canada, we didn't even have a window, I don't think. So that was a bit like, what's the point? But you do get those little nuggets of information when you're on the ground that can make a broadcast. And that's the benefit of being at the track. So I hope it doesn't ever go fully remote because you need those little nuggets. But I accept that absolutely you can do it remotely because we get a lot of information through and through the world of WhatsApp and Twitter. I'm in all the F1 team WhatsApp groups. So if we don't know what's going on with Pierre Gasly's Alpine, a text message in there, or they'll put it in before anyone asks.
Really?
And we'll go, yeah, Gaz, he's got a gearbox issue, and immediately you're informed and that kind of thing. So
some of the magic
that goes with your remote or at the track. So yeah, you know,
that's true. Some of the magic disappears when you find out stuff like this. So obviously we've had
yeah,
Sean...
I was just wary of saying too much now.
Don't want to break the fourth wall. Obviously, we've had Sean Kelly on here several times, F1 Statman. And so when you hear the commentators going, and this is the first time since 1847 that a goat with three legs has crossed over at the apex, I go, where have they got that from? You go, well, it's, you know, Sean. But obviously, now that the audiences have access to live timings and a lot more information, multi-viewer, choosing your onboard, the commentator's advantage is slightly diminished, because that used to be the magic purview of the commentators with all that information. Is it more challenging with a more informed audience, do you think?
I'd say so, yeah. But the audience at home, even with all that information, they can obviously absorb it probably in more depth, because they're in a relaxed environment and they're able to kind of do all that, whereas we are not, and we're quickly glancing at things. Qualifying, we still have a few things up our sleeve that people don't, you know, and that is one of the benefits of that, is that there are still some things in our commentary box that not everyone can get access to at home, and I won't reveal the magic on that one, because I feel like I've spoiled it a lot for other people already. but look, we also look, I'm a broadcaster. The whole team is the BBC team, I think, is a great laugh, and we have quite a revolving crew, and we have Formula One drivers with us who are bringing that insight that nobody else can possibly deliver. Like, we have Jack Aitken in the box in Saudi Arabia. Perfect. Because who? Oliver Behrman getting subbed in. Oh, what other F1 drivers been subbed in recently for their first ever Grand Prix? Oh, Jack Aitken. There you go. Perfect insight into how Behrman's mentality was going to be. So you're there, and I like to think our personality and broadcast skill is what also attracts people to listen, because, you know, we're telling stories, or, you know, when there's a red flag, we are there holding it together. I remember my first ever F1 TV commentary 2 years ago now, the Japanese Grand Prix, where Max Verstappen won, didn't win, then won the championship.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of rain. We were on air for an hour and a half of pure red flag, nothing going on the track. And that's where you do your job. And me, Jolyon Palmer, Sam Collins, we're chatting here, there, and everywhere. We were going back talking about the history of Honda and their engine supplying. And then we're also talking about what F1 car collections do you have at home? Palmer, have you got your own Renault? Or who's got the nichest, you know, car collection? Get involved. Let us know what you've got at home.
Yeah,
and then it becomes a bit of a call-in show, which is great. And so that's how you're keeping people entertained. And you don't get that. Mm. Yeah, you can have multi-view, you can have whatever. But you don't... you can have the information. But are you being entertained? I don't think so.
It's so funny that there's two very distinct skills there, the commentary of in race and then like the FP1 crew. I'm glad Sky have sort of cottoned onto that and seem to have different crews in for FP1. So when you have Natalie Pinkham in there leading FP1, it's a completely different type of broadcasting. Yeah. It's a bit more test cricket, and I really enjoy
practice
that.
Practice is a podcast with a bit of F1 action in the background.
Yeah, in the especially the BBC practice coverage. Are you doing that? Are you doing the practice coverage at the moment?
Every session so, live.
I used to listen to it more when I was in a physical office. So I would be skiving. I would arrange my work and arrange meetings around the fact that I could listen to FP1 and have an earbud in. But that is very much like an extended FP1 podcast. I've been on the Checkered Flag podcast once, you know. I got invited on once. Everyone yelled at me. Except Jenny, she's so lovely. But everyone else yelled at me, and then I didn't get invited back again. I think it might have been because of the things I said.
What did you say?
I don't know. I was just giving opinions, and then Andrew Benson yelled at me. Palmer yelled at me. He looked really angry. I was there. Is he still on it?
Sounds about right.
Is he still on it?
No. Jolyon, I think he's doing a few races for us. He mainly does F1 TV now. Okay. But no, look, that's part of the fun. And I when I got dropped into the BBC's coverage, I am quite a bit younger. I am way more inexperienced, and you're fighting for your life to try.
Did you get yelled at? Tell me, Benson yelled at you, and then I'll feel better.
Oh, the amount of points I've been shut down on by Andrew Benson. Oh, always, yeah. But it's good. I now I get enjoyment out of it. rather than feeling that's, like, oh my God, what have I just said?
That's like when I speak to Joe Saywood and it's just constantly, no, you're wrong, shut up. I'm just used to it now. Yeah. I'm just used to that level of just being beaten down. Harry, thank you so much for your time. I'm so excited for your opportunities going forward. And this is probably the last time we'll get to speak to you because like you're inevitably going to be Billy Big Nuts. We'll have to come with a big checkbook next time.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I did tell you my fee is now astronomically high.
And I said to you, all I can offer you is the love and support of an informed Missed Apex community. But go and follow Harry. Oh, poor Harry. I've got more followers than you. That's not going to last. Go and follow at I'm Harry Benjamin now. And then we can take credit for you blowing up and being famous.
Okay. Deal. Nice. Deal. I'll take that. I'll take that.
Harry Benjamin, thank you so much for your time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Great stuff there. Very, very excited for him. Now, let's talk F1 sponsorships with somebody who has worked with the top F1 teams and with F1 drivers to bring those sponsorships to life. And without the money, the machine doesn't go around. Anyway, it's me and Matt talking to Tim Silvey. Now, here on Missed Apex Podcast, we sometimes get to speak to people who are in the paddock. But what about the power behind the power? Today, me and Matt get to speak to somebody who seems to have a finger in every pie and knows everyone in the F1 industry. It's sponsorship guru and content creator from Motormouth, Tim Silvey. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Spanners. How are you?
I'm okay. You downplay how much, but you know everyone, Tim.
I mean, the black book is getting better. To be honest, the podcasting stuff has helped, as you probably know. Like, you do these things, you get people on the show, and you end up talking to people for, you know, more than just the show itself, and the black book expands. So, yeah, it's getting there. It's getting there.
Yeah, it's the networking after the recording stops, you see. And when people want to speak to you after the pod, I always sit and spend that time. Joe Saywood, Uncle Joe, as soon as the recording's finished, he goes, right, very good. Boom, done. He's off. But today, me and Matt are really, really curious about your work in F1 sponsorship. So tell us a little bit about what you've done there, working with brands, working with drivers.
Yeah, a bit of both. So I started out in 2005 when I worked. I lucked into a job with a sports marketing agency called Badansky Sponsorship Limited, which was a relatively big player at the time. And they were working with Toyota and did for many, many years. And when Toyota were in F1 with Panasonic, we worked with Panasonic to manage that relationship with a guy called Richard Cregan, who was the team principal at the time, who went on to be CEO at Yas Marina Circuit and then at Sochi. And it just went on from there. It did headed up the team that did ING Bank's sponsorship of the Renault F1 team, which was a huge deal at the time. And I got to wear some really fetching bright orange polo shirts and white trousers with orange shoes, which was fun. And lots of other things in between with Epsom and Mercedes, and lots of work with Hilton for many years and their sponsorship with McLaren. So lots of big global brands and activating those partnerships in Formula One and a little bit in Formula E and golf and a few other sports too.
Okay. So quickly, what is an activation? I see everybody using this word all the time. From your point of view, working with the brand that is in Formula One, what is an activation? And also, because I'm famous for multi-part questions, how do you decide the worth of it? Like, how do you decide your brand is getting out of this activation what it needs?
Well, to the first part of your question first, the activation is effectively whatever campaigns or activity you do around the partnership. So if I'm brand A and I'm like, I want to sponsor Red Bull, I go, right, here's a check for £50 million a year. And in return, I get given a load of assets. So that could be like 6 hours of Max's time, 6 hours of Checo's time, 100 hospitality tickets in the paddock club for the year that you have to divvy up between your key focus races in your key markets, IP, image rights, video rights, rights-free filming days, what else? All sorts of interesting bits and pieces. So you get given a list of assets, and depending on how much money you spend is how many assets you get back. And then you generally, as a brand, either are lucky enough to have a big marketing team that have worked in Formula One before, and you give all those assets to your marketing team, and they go off and create content or campaigns or above the line, below the line, TV ads, whatever it might be. Or you go to a sports marketing agency and go, here's another load of money, another many, many more millions to activate that partnership. So there you go, Mr. Sports Marketing Agency. Now take these assets that we've got from the team, turn it into marcoms, and deliver us value on our sponsorship. And it used to be like when the ING days, for example, with Renault, it was, here's a load of money, we want as much of that car as we can. We just want to splash it with ING branding, full awareness play, eyeballs on the car. That's it. And trackside branding like at Spa. But very hard to measure, although they did. And actually, the awareness of ING grew massively throughout the 3 years they were involved until Piquet crashed in a straight line in Singapore and ruined it. And then other brands nowadays want much more measurement and data. So you have to put KPIs against what you're doing and make sure that you know, you're getting value for your money effectively, and it's measurable.
That is something that the podcasts industry is struggling with at the moment. So if you're on YouTube, it shows the number there, but no one really knows the impact of podcasting, and a download doesn't always mean someone's listened. So that kind of data-driven stuff is actually like wrecking podcast advertising.
It is. Yeah, it's a constant challenge for us podcasters. But, you know, there are ways around it. And, you know, if you work with a brand in the podcasting world who give you a trackable URL and they're selling a product, then, you know, it's easier to do. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the data around podcasting is certainly not as strong as, you know, the granular detail you get on YouTube.
It's so fascinating you talking about these the units, so things like paddock passes and stuff like that. So the only time I've managed to get into the paddock club was something like that. So one of the sponsors just had a number of paddock passes, and a listener happened to be working for that. I'm swimming in paddock passes. Do you want one? But you know, these things are they're highly valued, especially when it comes to like networking and stuff. So you know, if you've got a handful of paddock passes and you want to have your meeting in the Ferrari club, you know, that's very prestigious. One interesting thing though, the Ferrari hospitality at Silverstone, empty. McLaren and Red Bull, absolutely pumping and heaving.
Yeah. I mean, it ebbs and flows. You have the paddock. A lot of people, when they start working in Formula One, they get confused between the paddock and the paddock club. Yeah. The paddock is obviously that, you know, that 1 kilometer stretch behind the team garages on the ground floor. And then generally speaking, at most racetracks, the paddock club is on the first, second or third floor, or all of the above, like a Yas Marina circuit. I think they've got three levels, I think. Same in Miami, I think two or three levels with a terrace up the top. And yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the top teams have their suites, which can cost anywhere from sort of $8,000 per person upwards.
Crazy.
Some of them are a lot more. And I mean, in Vegas, it was like $30,000 for one ticket in the paddock club in Vegas. So the top teams have them, and you go and have lovely food and lots of entertainment and driver appearances, and you get tours of the paddock and all sorts of stuff. Or you can just buy into a general restaurant if you're average Joe. If you're a very wealthy average Joe and you've got 10 grand to burn, you can buy into the paddock club. You don't have to be with a team.
Oh, me and Brad did feel very, very fancy that day. And you're right over the pit lane as well, and seeing what's going on the pit wall and stuff. Oh, do you know that? It's ruined it. It's just ruined it. I can't face the prospect of just going and plonking down at Stone now.
Mate, I took my youngest, my middle child Hector to Silverstone last year. It was boiling hot day on the Sunday.
Yeah, it's always hot. Yeah.
So hot. And without wanting to sound like an absolute usually I'm in the paddock because that's where I work. It's not because I've paid to go there. I can't afford to go to the paddock or the paddock club, right? So it's because of work. So I'm usually experiencing Formula One in that way.
Yeah.
When I go. This time I was in, I can't remember what corner we were on. I got him into the paddock through some mates and he met Lando Norris and all this. It was really, really cool. And he's a huge McLaren fan. He's only six. And anyway, after that, we went to one of the grandstands and really it wasn't good. I mean, it was not a pleasant experience because it was boiling hot. There was no shade. I had to buy an overpriced hat for like 60 quid or something ridiculous. The toilets were overflowing. The food ran out. The beer ran out. It was just not a fun experience. And when you're paying £300-£500 for one grandstand ticket at Silverstone.
I think you're lucky to get it for that.
Yeah, you kind of expect better. So put me back in the paddock.
Yeah, no. It's impossible to tell that story and not sound like a. I've had a similar story where me and Brad, we went out to Maggots Beckett's to see them going through those turns is spectacular. But we quickly turned to each other and we're like, we need to get back to the champagne. We need to get back. I think one of the things Matt is particularly interested in, and not for selfish reasons at all, Matt, is the driver sponsorship side.
Yeah, I mean, not for any reasons of my wife's second Formula One novel.
Oh,
but you did used Free to research. Work with drivers in driver sponsorship, and I was just curious if you could, again, entirely not for reasons of my wife's novel, lay out kind of how that works from the driver and driver sponsorship side.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of similar, really. So I worked with a number of drivers, the most well-known probably being now Jamie Chadwick. So I managed Jamie when she was in Beach Dean, Aston Martin in British GT alongside Baker, Paul Hollywood, who was her teammate. A lot of people don't know that Paul Hollywood, apart from being an excellent baker of bread, is also a racing driver. So she was with him and we were deciding where to go with her career. And we chose to put her into single seaters and we put her through that sort of F3 testing route. And with her and others like Max Chilton, who we took into Formula One from GP2 at the time, it's a very similar process, except you have to work a bit harder to find a niche. So, like with Max, for example, we did a really healthy deal with a watch brand called Armin Strom, who you've probably never heard of, which is a very unique, and rare, watch company. And we did a deal with them for cash, quite a lot of cash, a decent chunk of money. And then they made him a run of limited edition Max Chilton watches with his branding on that he could sell and get commission from. And in return, they got a little bit of exposure through at the time, because social media wasn't as big, branding on his car, appearances at their events and so on. But it really just depends on the driver. I mean, if you can find a niche with that particular driver, it could be their location. It might be that they're part of a certain community. It might be that they're very good at business conversations. And you can use them for business purposes. You know, going with Tom Chilton, who I used to manage, he used to go to offices and do talks. You know, it really depends, but it's not an easy gig getting money for racing drivers.
Are you responsible for Tom Chilton doing all the karting safety videos?
No,
is that you? Is that your fault?
No, he did that before me. So that's fine. You know, but bless him. I love Tom Chilton. I mean, him and Max couldn't be more different. Max is extremely business focused and is actually now a very successful businessman with businesses in his own right and property and supercars and all sorts. Tom is a racer but was great fun with us. He knew how to schmooze a sponsor just by being Tom. Racing driver sponsorship is a tough gig, but we did well and we made Max and Tom and Jamie and Struan Moore and Ollie Webb as well, the endurance driver. We did them several deals and commercial fundraising. But it's a tough business.
So just to follow up a little bit, how do these drivers come to you? Do you like go seek them out at kart tracks all over the UK? Are you at an agency where drivers send a CV and a videotape of how, you know, personable they can be, therefore you should take them on as clients?
Oh, you're imagining him at trackside going, you got Moxie, kid, give me a car sometime.
No,
exactly.
You literally do that, but I had one awful moment where so I was looking at two drivers that one was Struan Moore, who at the time was racing in things like Blancpain Endurance, and he was also racing in Formula 3 with Lannan, who are great feeder series race team, really, really super successful, have lots of big names that go through them, bit of a sort of Carlin type team. And the two teammates they had was Struermore and a guy called George Russell.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like, I'll pop down to Snetterton and watch this race. It might have been F4 actually at the time. I can't remember. And I think George was leading the championship, but Struan and him were like, they were close. There wasn't much between them on track. And I went to watch them both. And because my job was to raise them money and market them, I looked at Struan, who had long hair, looked cool, dressed brilliantly, wore rings and was like wicked. I was like, that guy's marketable. I looked at George and was like,
oh,
boring.
No.
So
Struan,
too tall and you know, doesn't look that cool. Let's go with Struan. And you can, you know, the rest is history.
You're like that guy who turned down the Beatles.
I know, but Struan had a good career and he's still going. He's in driver management now himself. But yeah, you literally do go to racetracks, but also it's word of mouth. You know, it's once you start getting a bit of a name, or, you know, your black book increases, as you often hear of opportunities, things come up, things crop up, you know, and people recommend, you know, people are nice and you get recommendations. So it was a bit of a mix, to be honest with you.
So how important is the driver personality then when you're doing this? Because I'm assuming it's going to become increasingly important. And the driver at the moment who is absolutely smashing it, Bottas has just done this amazing car hire commercial. And yeah, he's so good. I want to know the direction, because his comedic timing, it's not like, oh, so bad it's good. It's genuinely comedy genius. And Steak are getting so much out of him right now.
I mean, he's doing so well. He's built this persona, which is so marketable. I mean, it's for drivers like him, it's all about the personality. Like every deal he will do now will be, will have a comedic angle. I mean, a comedic angle, even like, so The Race, who I do some work with, they've got a podcast, as you probably know.
Don't listen to him.
No idea what you're talking about.
Well, we'll beat all this.
Yeah. Well, for the unblacklisted podcasts, there is a podcast by The Race. We'll get you on it, Spanners, don't worry.
Yeah.
And they have a Bottas sympathy corner now, you know, just which is like, and he's totally, and Bottas has even voiced the little segment, you know, so he's very open to this kind of thing. And for brands, this is just like manna from heaven. It's like, God, you know, a guy that doesn't take himself too seriously, has a profile, is funny, and is genuinely a nice person. And he's a dream to deal with. So personality is hugely important. And then, you know, you look at, There were when Paul d'Aresta was around, you know, people, rightly or wrongly, I'm not saying he's boring, okay, but rightly or wrongly, some people perceived him as boring, and it didn't do his career any good in or out of the car. Personality driven is very important.
Only old UK people will remember this, but there was a snooker player called Steve Davis, who was the ultimate boring snooker player, and then Spitting Image did a spoof of him where he told everyone he wanted his nickname to be Steve Interesting Davis to make himself more marketable. And that really stuck. In the F1 paddock, since we're talking about the drivers there, you probably could look at Ricciardo to be one of the first real, like, big, I'm going to make every interview into an improv session. And then Lando Norris did it and then has kind of stopped doing it.
Yeah, he has. And I've seen Daniel Ricciardo a couple of times, because he's exactly the same all the time. You know, he comes into the McLaren paddock club, for example, or did come into the McLaren paddock club when he was there, and he was always hilarious, and the sponsors genuinely love him, because you know, if you're the CMO of some giant company and you can shake a guy's hand and he smiles at you and wants to talk to you and is asking questions, you know, that's so valuable, and goes such a long way for a race team. As opposed to a guy who's closed off and, you know, doesn't really want to talk, it's a problem. And having been in those conversations where you're talking about using driver time, which is so limited, and you're like, we've got a new campaign, we want a video, we need a driver to come and show up and be good and perform in this video. Having a driver that will show up and be funny and engaging and read the auto cue and not cause problems for the CMO and for the sports marketing agency, again, is so important. And they're the ones at the end of the day who spend the money. So if you are difficult, it's not going to do anyone any good.
Who's the least of that in the F1 paddock, do we think? Who's the most boring, just focusing on sport?
I mean, I've got to be careful what I, have, yeah, what I say, haven't I? I might want to get back into the sponsorship game one day. I don't know. I mean, I've worked with a few of them. To be honest, they've all been pretty good. I did some stuff with Team Viewer and George Russell when he was brilliant, you know, really wanted to try hard to make it work. And he was a perfectionist really with it all. Same with Lewis when I did, I've only worked with Lewis once for an Epsom campaign when he was with, a few years ago at Mercedes. And he found it challenging because he's not a natural performer. You know, he's a racer and he does his best. And he's a perfectionist, wants everything he does to be perfect. But again, he was fine. I mean, there were no issues with him. The only person I've had the only person I found slightly difficult was Rosberg when he was on the podcast. And I just found him a little bit distant. But I would be if I was on some random bloke's podcast from his bedroom and I've, you know, what am I doing here?
Who is this guy? You know, I've got, it's when it's like the rotation of just their day. Maybe they weren't paying attention, but they just happened to end up somewhere. We had that with, the names escaped me. Felipe Massa's engineer, Rob Smedley was on Mist Apex and he had absolutely no idea that he was going to be on Mist Apex. He was like, what now? okay. And he was really, really polite, but you could tell the whole time he was like, I do not want to be on this random idiot's podcast. I was actually going to say Lewis Hamilton for like the least forward like that and being like, he's super serious and closed off. And also I think the media kind of shut him down early on in his career whenever he tried to make humor. You know, there was the famous Ali G impression. But yeah, he's actually probably the driest of the drivers. Matt?
Well, I just want to get into that the level of fame that you have definitely will play into the amount of reserve you bring to any situation. And again, I know this through my wife's day job where she works with some incredibly famous people. And the more famous they are, generally, the more reserved they are. Have you found that too?
I mean, it really varies. You know, we've met a lot of people through the podcast. I know we're straying away from sponsorships slightly.
Fine.
But, you know, we've interviewed so many people, nearly 200 people now, and a lot of them are very, very high profile. And they've been lovely. I mean, I don't know what it is about podcasting. People let their guard down, don't they? And, you know, even Rosberg, when we had him on, he talked about his lack of confidence and imposter syndrome and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we had Günther Steiner, who after we pressed stop recording, he hung around and asked us questions. You know, he was lovely. There was no like holding back or being reserved. So Jen, I can't really think of an individual of high profile status that has been difficult or challenging and not cooperative. They've all been good, including Smedley, actually. He was all right. He must have liked us more. He was all right.
I think because he knew he was going to be on your podcast in advance, I think. I'll tell that story another time, how we ended up in that position. It's like basically not too dissimilar to, what's the Notting Hill, where the guy accidentally ends up being in a press junket for the Horse and Hound.
The situation
was not a million miles away from that. Ryan Gosling was my example of someone so famous, he won't even have pictures of him eating anything. So he always like covers his jacket over when he eats stuff. So it is related to sponsorship, Tim, because these are all the things that make people marketable. And our audience would be disappointed if we stayed on topic for too long anyway. I thought the direction you were going to take us in, Matt, was with Jamie Chadwick, because when you're talking about marketability and having that niche, obviously she has the niche in that she's a very high profile woman in the sport. But Matt has often posited that maybe sponsors would be a little bit more hands off with the prospect of a woman driver.
Yes, I think they probably are. I mean, I think that the tide is changing and we are seeing, the good thing is we're seeing some perceived women's brands now entering the sport, you know, Charlotte Tilbury and stuff like that. You know, there's brands coming in that are seeing women's motorsport as an avenue for their marketing. We did struggle in the early days with Jamie to get traction with brands. There was a lot of interest and a lot of goodwill and people wanting to do things, but getting them to actually put their hand in their pocket and spend the money was difficult. Certainly more difficult than the men that we were dealing with at the time. But Jamie has and continues to change the game. And she's, I don't know if you've noticed, she's getting better and better at the media side of it. Her personality is starting to come out. She was quite dry for a long time, but she's really starting to come out of her shell. And she's doing some great initiatives that are raising the profile of women's motorsport. So I think things will change, and they are changing. You know, we're seeing these brands come into F1 Academy, you know, Tommy Hilfiger and others. So I think things are moving in the right direction there, but it's certainly, from my experience to date, it's easier to get traction with guys than it is with girls.
That's interesting. So Matt, that kind of validates what you've said, but some of the
I'm right again.
Right again. So with the FIA Academy, we're not used to that level of motorsport having that level of attention, but a lot of the drivers there are leveraging the social media side of it. And I wonder how much involvement guys like you would have in that. So I think the best example is Bianca Bustamante, Philippines represented, is very out there in social media, and in fact has been involved in quite a few like Twitter storms and things like that. But that's very deliberate, isn't it? Like, let's use that side of things.
Yeah, and the social side of things is super important. I don't know what the sort of asset list is like when you go in and sponsor an F1 Academy team, but I'd imagine a lot of the assets are as they have been for many, many years. I mean, the assets that you get through any kind of motorsport sponsorship haven't really changed that much, apart from digital. You know, you do now have, as part of your list of deliverables within your list of assets within a package that you get from your race team or your driver or whatever property it is that you're sponsoring, obviously there is now more weighting behind. You'll have X amount of posts on an Instagram feed or on TikTok or on X or whatever it might be. There's a lot more of that stuff available to brands now than there was historically, but generally speaking, the assets haven't really changed that much. And although the social media side of things is important, it's not the be all and end all. And people like her do need to be careful, because brands look at this, you know, if there is a social media storm, marketers are not stupid. You know, they will look at that, and if it's not up to scratch, they just simply won't work with you. You know, you've got to be clean. You've got to be brand savvy and not just go off and say whatever you want all of the time. Unfortunately, you just can't.
You've got to watch what you click like on as well.
You really do. Pay attention. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to ask a question from a brand point of view. Let's say you're looking at something like F1 Academy. Is a brand getting involved with the team because the team is successful, or can they sometimes just say, I want to sponsor this particular driver in a team because that driver appeals to whatever they think they need to be selling to people?
Yeah, you can sponsor a driver as opposed to the team. The only thing that you'll have to negotiate through is what assets the team own versus the driver. So the team, for example, may own half of the helmet or three quarters of the car. So you might have, if I'm the driver of a race team, I might be, as part of my contract with the race team, say I'm going to drive in Formula 2 or Formula 3, I'd be like, right, I don't know, High Tech, I'm going to, as part of my deal, whether I'm paying for the seat or you're paying me, I want the side pods and the rear wing end plates. They're mine to sell as my personal sponsorship. Okay, fine. We'll sell the rest of the car. You can have those bits. Go off and sell those parts of the car. And those parts of the car might form the basis of your sponsorship offering as an individual. So you could, you know, your package would be like, look at me, I've done all these races, I've come first loads. Not only do you get the side pods and the rear wing end plates, but you get me twice a year at your office and blah, blah, blah. You know, the list goes on. So you can negotiate with whatever you want, but you can add anything into that asset list. And this is what frustrates me about young drivers when they're trying to stand out, is that there are so many things you could do. I mean, if you live near a go-kart track, go and negotiate a deal with your go-kart track to have the track once for free for half a day at a quiet day in the year, and then put that in your sponsorship deck to say to sponsor X, who might be a local or a nationwide company, not only do you get all these assets and photos and tickets and blah, 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 you also get half a day free coaching from me at a go-kart track with 20 of your key customers. Go and find a friend with a supercar that can come down and do some hot laps. You know, that immediately stands you out from the crowd.
Yeah.
Nobody does it. They just do, I've done this, look how good I am at racing, and I'll put your logo on a car. And that's not going to get you anywhere, quite frankly, in a sea of sameness.
You can see it at the events you put on at the Motormouth karting days. Now that I see what is happening at those events and you having this conversation, I'm piecing it all together. You know, that's how you suddenly have a couple of hypercars going around the track, and you go, yeah. I'm looking at that going, yay, go karts. And but you're looking at that. That's like a massive networking event for you. You've brought people in left, right, and center. It's a web. I could never do it. Yeah. It's the confidence you need to go out and network like that is high.
Yeah, it is. But again, you know, after many years in the sport and you know building that network, it's not like you know I'm not going out with a sort of begging bowl trying to you know drum up things and having to cold call people. It is literally calling on friends. You know, the guy that provides the cars for that event, you know, he's become a bit of a mate, and it's just like. Could you bring down a GT40? Yeah, of course I can. I'd love to show
That's
it off.
So cool. And,
you know, so it's but I think drivers do have to work hard for their money, and I'm not sure all of them appreciate the lengths they need to go to. I mean, sponsorship's a full-time job. It is hard work. And if you don't take it as seriously as you're racing, you're not going to get the money you need to go racing unless you're lucky enough to have a dad that is on the board at Hargreaves Lansdown.
Is that that's going to be a specific person, isn't it?
That's a reference, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
One last thing before you go, because I know for you, time is money. There are deals.
Spanish, I'm good for time, actually.
Oh, okay.
So don't rush. I just texted you, actually, just to say
right.
I'm all good for time. So
lovely.
Carry on.
In that case, the most interesting team sponsorship-wise in F1 has to be McLaren and Zak Brown. So like you're exactly like Zak Brown, because that was like the thing, wasn't it? That's his trade. That's what he brings to the team. And, you know, you even had the point where you had so much sponsorship. They wanted the revolving e-paper on the side.
Yeah, so McLaren have got it nailed. And a lot of it is down to Zak. I mean, Zak had a company called CSM, which he, at the time when he founded it, was JMI, Just Marketing International. It later became CSM, and it's just merged with Wasserman. But he, with that company, was a sports marketer. That's what he did. He connected brands. He had his roots in motorsport, obviously, with United Autosport. And when he became the boss over at McLaren, it was a great move for McLaren. And I think now they've got 50 sponsors there or thereabouts, give or take, which I would have thought has probably peaked. I don't know how you can go many more than that.
Yeah.
There's not the room on the car, but you know, you're going to have conflicts. You know, that is a lot of sponsors, but I was looking at it actually, and I worked out that in the last 12 months, interestingly, 12 sponsors have left McLaren and 13 have come in. So he's only net plus one. So, but having said that, he's done an amazing job to get all those brands in. And when you look at some of the other teams who've only got sort of 15, 16 sponsors, some of them are just technical partnerships or, you know, it's an amazing job that he's done. And that car is absolutely covered in brands. It's incredible.
Do you think that is going to change the way like boards approach race teams and who's in charge of them? Because he sort of originally came in almost like a team principal, but it seems like he smartly said, well, what we really need is an engineer who can make actual decisions and understands this. And what I need to focus on is getting money for this team for various reasons we don't have to go into. Do you think other teams are looking at this sort of structure and are like, we need to find a superstar like Zak to lead the fundraising charge for our team?
I mean, they should have them in place. I mean, they may not be as front facing as Zak, but all the teams have commercial directors who are there for a reason. And the reason is that they've worked on or have acquired sponsors in the past. And beneath them, they have a team of salespeople, and you have your partnership managers down to your, you know, your junior account execs who are all working on that stuff for the teams. So they have that in place. And I know lots of those people, and they're all really good operators. But I think without wanting to play down anything that Zak's done, I think you could probably place a handful of very top operators in a place like McLaren and expect to do quite well, because they've got a great name, a great history, great story. As long as you've got the right narrative, you're going to do all right. Obviously, you go somewhere like Haas, and no disrespect to Haas, it's a much, much harder sell. You know, the guys there, and they're good people. Like, I know them. They're good salespeople.
Are you doing the equivalent of car stapping? Oh, it's just the car. That's the equivalent.
Yeah, exactly. But it kind of is. You know, it's Williams have done an amazing job. You know, I think they've been super creative with the whole Duracell thing.
Oh yeah.
And you know, getting brands like Kraken involved, which may or may not be a good thing for the sport, but bags of cash.
The whole Duracell thing, I have heard a rumor that they just did that and hoped that Duracell would buy into it.
No.
I have no doubt. And there are countless examples of that over the years. I mean, being a freelance sponsorship agent for a long, long time and consultant for agencies, you know, every now and again you hear about these stories where they do something creative like that. Or even, you know, a bloke walking down the paddock bumps into the CEO of a giant company and they have a chat and it's like, well, you should do this. Why don't you do this? Yeah, maybe we should. But how much will it cost? About 50 million quid. You give me 10%. Let's do it. Deal done. And they walk away, you know, an average Joe like me walks away with, you know, 5 million quid in their pocket. And there are deals being done in all sorts of interesting ways. Some are very, very structured and very well very well done and surrounded in data and statistics. Others are literally having a beer with a very normal bloke in the paddock and you do a deal and you make millions.
How that smoozing, that networking and that let's grab a quick pint skill is, I imagine you're very, very good at that. That's got to be one of the most important skills of the job.
It's the only skill I've got, Spanners. So it's, I said this to someone the other day. I was on someone else's podcast and it was, you know, younger people than us. Let's just say that. So, you know, we're
stupid young
on
people.
Stupid yeah. young people. But he was saying, he was like, you know, what advice or, you know, what attributes do you need? And for me personally, my only attribute is talking. I have nothing else. I have people skills.
I feel seen.
And I don't have anything else. So I talk a lot. I network a lot. I network an awful lot. Yeah. Like that's where I spend every day doing some networking at least. And that has been my only attribute. I built up a black book through talking to people. I have no other skills whatsoever apart from networking and, you know, schmoozing, as you put it, you know, just trying to talk to people and make things happen.
I've got my... So obviously I talk for a living, but my worst case scenario is that networking and going to that person and just assuming that they'd want to talk to me or that I can offer them anything. So I'm going to have to do a lot of it in Miami and I'm absolutely terrified. So I might try and hire you as my life coach or something when I get out there. It's just that walking up to people. I've seen like one of my heroes, Dr. Stephen Novella. He was Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. He's 4 meters away from me and I can't even just walk up to him and talk to him because I'm just like, why would he want to talk to me? That
people
initial
do though, don't they? They do. Will. I mean, yeah. I don't know if you're going to the Black Book Forum this year in April, which is sort of, it's a bit of a mainstay now of the calendar for people in motorsport. A lot of important people go there from racing and it's late April. It's at the Oval in London. And it's that scenario. And that's where I remember I went there for the first time a few years ago and put my big boy pants on. And I was the most junior person in the room and probably the most inexperienced. And there was all these important people in suits. And I forced myself to go and talk to people and just be like, all right, how's it going? You know, and I've done deals at that event now. I did a deal there last year. And just by walking up to people and saying hello. And on the whole, people are pretty happy to say hello because they're there doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Big boy pants. I'm going to have that in my head. Put your big boy pants on. Since we've got you for a little bit longer then, the most fascinating sponsorship thing happening in F1, I think, at the moment is between the two teams that have changed their names recently. Yeah. So Visa Cash App and Stake Sauber Kick Team F1. There's not a Stake F1 team. The people at Stake are not running that F1 team. But naming rights, that's really big.
Yeah. So they've spent, I don't know, in the region of £50 million a year on that. And they've taken the name of the team for 2 years before it changes again. And it feels a bit like the ING days. You know, it's a big time badging exercise and it's worked. I mean, I'd never heard of Stake 2 years ago or even a year ago maybe. And, you know, they're a hugely wealthy, successful company run by a very wealthy young bloke. And now, all of a sudden, the power of Formula One, many people now know who Stake are. So fair play to him. Even though they're not activating much in the way that we talked about earlier, you know, with those traditional assets, what they are doing is amplifying their brand via some serious logo placement. And to be honest, even though it's quite a traditional and outdated way of doing it, it's having an impact. So fair play to him. I think it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And Visa, yeah, you know, the same. What a mouthful of a name. Trouble is, that's just become sort of RB, isn't it? You know.
Yeah.
Visa doesn't really get a look in now.
Well, I'm insisting on calling it Visa Cash App RB because they took the money. That's the name of the team. I don't think you get to take the money and then go, no, but call us VCARB because that's a cool and sexy name. No, Visa Cash App RB. But does Visa like that, mind that? That they're kind of going, just call us RB, actually. Don't worry about it.
I don't know. I mean, I read something on LinkedIn the other day by another sponsorship guy who was like, you know, this... You may not like the name, but it's been talked about so much that it's actually done it. It's done its job because, you know, everyone's like, what a crazy name, you know, Visa. Blah, blah, blah. But you're saying Visa all the time. You know, it's again, it's back in the narrative. It's back in the conversation of Formula One. So I don't think they'll mind one bit. I think they're probably pretty happy with the way it's all gone.
Yeah. And if you want a customized debit card that's connected to your Cash App, you know, is there a better choice?
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I said, I am very, very purchasable. Incredibly cheap.
I'm the same.
Yeah.
Loads of space on my trumpet case. That's all I'm saying.
I will do things for money. Just before you go then, how's this for a marketing sort of tactic? Because now we've finally got our butts in gear and got some merch, and we've got our Wrong But First hoodies, and Matt's got his Wrong But First t-shirt. So
very nice.
Giving that to prominent people and going, hey, do you, because people love free stuff, don't they? They love gizzits.
Yeah.
That's what we used to always call it in business, gizzits. If you turn up and there's a mouse mat, people go, ooh, mouse mat. I think you can be the richest person in the world, but if someone offers you a mouse mat, you're like, oh, mouse mat.
Yeah, take it. Love free stuff. I like that. Well, give it to the roster, Spanners. We've got the talent roster there. You can give all of them one and they'll stick it on their socials.
Absolutely. So actually, that's one of the big things you're doing at the moment is the WTF1 talent roster, where you've got influencers out and about kind of wielding that power that they've built up from their social media apps like TikTok. It's beyond the likes of you and me because we're old, but it's massive and there's some great creators on there.
Yeah, there are, and TikTok is a bit of a minefield because it's very hard to understand the peaks and troughs within it. You know, some creators absolutely boom on it and then just stagnate. Yeah. Others continue to boom, others go down. Instagram is much more reliable in that sense. You know, we've got very clear growth patterns on Instagram, but we've got 35 creators now and they're all doing wonderful things. And we've got people from all over the world, as far as India and Australia and Brazil, UK and US and various other places in between, and people from the LGBTQ+ community and racing pride ambassadors and all sorts of interesting men, women, and it's a really fun thing, and they're doing really well, and it's booming, especially the US. You know, we're doing a load of deals for them, and I hope they're all happy. But they're fantastic. They're all great to work with. So, yeah, sling them a few free hoodies, mate.
I'll go for it. From our point of view, like obviously we found creators in TikTok and then gone, oh no, that's really good content. Come and do podcasting with us.
Yeah.
Whereas I think a lot of establishments turn their nose up a little bit at TikTok creators. But do you know what? It's a meritocracy. No one has to say, no one has to give them permission to go and do it. And you can't really get a leg up. So anyway, thank you for putting your big boy pants on and talking to us.
I've got one more. I had a question for you, actually.
Oh, okay.
I'm always interested to hear what other people think about the sponsorship industry when they don't necessarily work in it or it's not their day to day. And when we were chatting on WhatsApp, we mentioned Aramco and stuff like that and looking at that whole world. And the you know, a big Saudi corporation coming in and sponsoring Aston Martin and Formula One. I'm curious to know what you guys think about that. Like, do you look at that and think positive thoughts, or are you like, oh no, you know, and another big Middle Eastern company, particularly a Saudi one, coming in to try and sports wash, or do you look at it in some other kind of way as a consumer, I suppose?
I think we, especially growing up in the in the 80s watching F1, you know, it was all tobacco sponsorship. You know, we're used to seeing like Carlsberg and Heineken everywhere. So you can't have a massive amount of a moral compass as a F1 fan and get outraged by everything when you enjoy a sport that goes around the world, flies, has a massive carbon footprint, goes to all sorts of countries and different types of ruling systems. So I don't think you can get like massively outraged that a large amount of money has come in. But I suppose every single time, you know, when you get Kick, Stake F1, Sauber and Visa Cash App RB, which aren't racing names, and when it's on the surface and it's exposed, you can no longer have that fantasy of the money isn't controlling everything. So when it's something like Aramco, you go, okay, that's like a big, bold, there's a statement of it. And there's a creeping sense that, you know, F1 is going to end up being owned, Saudi owned. And in those nations, you know, the blur between company money and nation money is different. So there's a little bit of a tingle there where you kind of go, oh, our thing is being bought. So I think, I don't think there's like an outrage about it. How do you feel, Matt?
I've always said Formula One is a marketing business that has racing attached to it. You know, my personal feelings about Saudi Arabia and Aramco aside, it's very clear that, and they are far from the only ones who are wanting to change their perception in the world of how they are. And ventures like this are very much a front end. Yeah. And the question of success is going to be ultimately delivered on the back end by behavior that we're not in charge of and we don't know how it's going to change. So, like, I understand what they're after with this. The other thing with Aramco that's particularly interesting is they've also made very big investments into solar energy, alternative energy, despite being what we would call a petro state, let's say.
Yeah.
And obviously the synthetic fuel that Formula One is moving to in 2026, allegedly, I mean, that's the plan. We've not seen it fully fleshed out yet. I mean, that potentially a game changer if they can develop and make viable a fuel source that doesn't add to carbon in the atmosphere for like planes or marine transport and stuff like that. That's potentially a huge deal. So I do see some upside there, but it also feels like, oh, you know, the big kids just came and took our lunch money a little bit too.
Yeah. No, it's interesting to hear that perspective. And I share those views. I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time in Saudi, and I think my view has changed over the years as I've met more and more Saudi nationals and spent time over there and talked to people about their opinions and views on, you know, bringing all this sport in. Because it's not just Formula One. They're doing it everywhere, aren't they? I mean, there's the boxing and I think, was it darts or snooker? I can't remember if it's Bahrain or Saudi. One of them went to... it was either snooker or darts went to one of each.
Oh, is it the Turkish league where the cup final is out in the Middle East?
Really?
Yeah, there's some European league where like the cup final is literally out in the Middle East, and you just go, no.
Well, there's the Diriyah season in Saudi where they have a whole host of different sporting events all at once, and you know they've obviously got the Formula E and the Formula One, and they're sponsoring F1 and doing all this stuff and sustainable fuels. It's just interesting to see, you know, the perspectives of people around it and whether it's actually moving the dial as far as the country goes and the brand and the other Saudi brands that are floating around the sport. So it's just interesting. But I mean, I don't have any major issue. I'm a massive boxing fan, and I watch all the boxing that goes on in Saudi. And although it's not like watching something at Wembley Stadium, it'll get there. So I'm sort of on the fence with the Saudi stuff, but for Formula One, you know, it's an injection of cash. I suppose at the end of the day, it's good.
I think from a fan point of view, lie to me a little bit. So when it's less on top, you know, so the stake F1 and the Visa cash up, I think the thing about that is that you're not lying to me well enough. So that's just let me have my delusion that it's sport first. Is that fair?
That's fair.
Is that unrealistic?
Anyway, it's still Sauber at the end of the day, isn't it? So
no, I refuse. You know. I'm following the money, just like you. You're my idol, Tim, because you do so many things that I feel like I can't do. But big boy pants is going to be in my head. Tim's telling me, put your big boy pants on. Go and follow Tim Silvey. Go and check out the Motormouth podcast because due to your networking, I mean, obviously we're a better podcast than you, but
clearly
due to just aesthetically. But due to your amazing networking, like the amount of great guests you have on there is mind blowing.
Yeah, it's good. We've had some good guests over the years, and it continues to go out weekly. It's really good fun, and I love it. It's just an opportunity to chat to interesting people, really, and that's why I love it so much.
It's chats in it. It's good fun. Tim Silvey, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, guys.
Good. And that's the end of our little bit of midweek content. We're enjoying having some midweek content. I hope you are as well. And you can tune into our race review live from 9:30 in the morning, I think. Oh, I'll tell you who we've got on. Whet your appetite. We've got Jono. He's Australian. So, yes, yes, tokenism. Yeah, let's get the Australian on because it's the Australian Grand Prix. He's actually going to be at the track as well. And then he's going to run back to be on the podcast. We have Christian Pedersen, which means there's chaos and editing to be done. And we've got Stuffy as well, who you should go and check out Stuffy's stuff online. He's doing some really good iRacing content over on TikTok at the moment with the new mini Super Formula cars and stuff. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of crashes. It's interesting. Follow me. I'm at SpannersReady on Twitter. Getting close to that 20K. Come on, help me out. And follow Matt at MattPT55 as well. All the links for everything are magically in the show notes below. I think a kindly elderly American has just magicked. He's not elderly. He has got a bus pass, though, so I feel like I can say that. All the links are in those show notes below. Wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.